Hello, dear heart. Welcome to the Flourishing Practitioners podcast, where we talk all things about space holding, caring for our clients, and succeeding in our businesses. We explore the wisdom from coaches, counselors, and healers. My name's Gabrielle Walker, and I'm so honored that you're here. Let's dive in.
Hi, everyone. In this episode, I sit with Trish Thompson, who is a supervisor of mine. She's also a counselor, psychotherapist, and does couples, individual, and group therapy. And she has decades of experience with education, counseling, and psychotherapy.
She has a deep love for the power of people coming together in a shared space. This was a really nourishing and beautiful one to share how we cover the different types of group, vulnerability in groups, and how that can feel both confronting and transformative, and the role of the facilitator in really creating a safe process rather than controlling the process, not forcing safety on a group and allowing a group to choose clean agreements and also endings. Trish mentions that she is really influenced by Irving Yalom, who is a psychiatrist who has done a lot of work on the dynamics of groups and people, what's present in the moment, allowing yourself to be witnessed as vulnerable while other people aren't witnessing you as well. This was a real joy to have this conversation.
So everyone, Trish Thompson is a supervisor of mine, a counseling supervisor, and I've asked her today to talk on group therapy or group dynamics and to share her wisdom. I'm really excited to be talking today, Trish.
Me too, Gabrielle. And the subject of group therapy is very close to my heart. So yeah, thank you for having this conversation. I'm looking forward to it.
The question I always start with is, what's on your heart today? And it doesn't have to be on the topic. It's just what's sitting.
Wow, nice question. Thinking about a recent family event that happened where my daughter got married, and it was a beautiful and joyous occasion. Lots of beautiful people, family, friends. It's come to mind because of the sense of, you know, bringing people together in a group and how beautiful it can be. So I think that's still sitting with me, has been sitting with me for a couple of weeks now. Yeah.
I love that. How would you describe your journey into working with groups?
Well, before I was a counselor, I was a school teacher, high school teacher. So I worked with groups every day, but in a very traditional educational setting, I guess, as schools are. I just loved it. I just love being with groups of people, doing something, having a shared goal around learning. So I guess that's where it started. Then when I went down the counselling path, you know, re-educated myself to be a counsellor rather than a teacher, although they go together so well. I had an opportunity to do some group therapy in the first organisation. It was a community-based organisation, and I got the position there as a counsellor but also as a therapy groups coordinator. Probably based on the experience I had. I was a school counselor for a long time as well before I was a counselor of adults. And I would run groups for young people about a variety of things. So then when I went into this community organization, I sort of graduated to work with adults in therapy groups. And it was just fantastic to see people come together with shared concerns, life experiences, and support one another. Also very difficult, challenging, sometimes scary, but so incredibly rewarding to see people make connections and ongoing relationships because of being brought together by shared life experiences.
That's so beautiful. And how would you, for those who don't know, describe like what group therapy is? Because a lot of us are familiar with individual therapy, but we might know what group therapy is.
It's a very important question. And I think it's important also to distinguish between the types of groups that are available to people. There are three main types. The first one, you'd call it a support group. An example of that might be people who are experiencing addiction, perhaps, or the loss of a loved one, some kind of issue where people come together and the idea isn't necessarily to change anything about themselves. It's just that they need support. Hearing other people in the same position is a helpful thing. So there are plenty of support groups out there on a variety of topics. The second sort of group is probably the most common and traditional one run by organisations, and that's a psychoeducation group. It might be based on things like anxiety or depression or eating behaviours, again, potentially addiction. And the purpose of a psychoeducation group is for the participants to learn strategies or coping skills or specific things to help them make a change in their life. And another really common one is Men's Behaviour Change Group. That's one that I've been involved in for many years, and that is to help people who are using aggressive, violent behaviours to not do that and to do something else instead. And then the third group, which is probably less common, is actually a psychotherapy group. They often run for longer periods of time, maybe even up to a year, as opposed to a psychoed group that might run 6 to 12 weeks. The therapy group, why it runs longer is that the people in the group and their interactions actually become part of the change process. So you're not necessarily learning something. There's not a curriculum. It's about people interacting and then learning from those interactions and understanding in real time what's going on between you and me, and why am I having this reaction and what's happening here, and to be able to process that in the group. Very challenging. It's probably the hardest sort of group facilitators would ever run.
I'm more interested in the last group, the psychotherapy group, but I also am curious, I guess I'll start with, because I'll naturally go back to the psychotherapy piece, but that men's behaviour change or men's educational change, because I know, especially as women working with men sometimes and navigating those changes of what we're asking for and trying to explain it sometimes in that maybe a more somatic or relational way than a person is understanding. Yeah, what were some of the challenges that you were encountering in that space? I know that's a very broad question.
So picking up probably, maybe unconsciously, what I struggled with in being a facilitator of that type of group, you know, being a psychotherapist, I certainly believe in participants being able to have a deep understanding of themselves in order to enact change. Men's behaviour change groups, of course, because really the outcomes are very much thinking about the safety of women and children, in particular in heterosexual-based groups. There are groups, just as an aside, there are groups for people in same-sex relationships as well. There also might be children involved. I think people are more familiar with men's behaviour change groups that have a heteronormative structure in mind. I feel like those groups had a particular urgency around men learning quickly to change their behaviour and to stop being violent. And for me, I found it hard to work within, say, that structure of psychoeducation, limited time where you probably can't quite get to what's underneath people's violent behaviour. And I think people really need to understand what's driving that in order to be able to choose something else. That's the challenge that I was feeling about working in that setting.
I relate. I haven't done any work specifically like that, but in instances where I have been in a space where there's an aspect of that, I've had the similar feelings and varying degrees of success with it. Slowly I'm developing my understanding of the energetic that it's better to hold. I've found it, and even this is not, I'm not saying that this is where men in the training are, but there's a different way of teaching men and women, not every man and woman, but there's different ways of explaining. And as women, we can be more relational, not always, but that there is a more of a ban, at least with women, there's more of a giving confidence and affirmation. And then with men, there's more of a calling out and more of a challenge in terms of how the discussion goes. I can imagine that would be a really fraught space in between there as well. The thing that was pinging with me from that as well is, what are some of the suggestions if there is, if you remove the urgency of that and there wasn't the urgency of that change becoming a quick change, what would be those deeper reasons, things that could come up for people in terms of realizing why they were enacting that behavior?
I think a lot of what we would see with men who are found their way into groups like that is, you won't be surprised to hear, you know, trauma of their own, often attachment trauma. So, you know, might have been sort of neglect, abuse, various things like that in their own childhood. So, you know, when there's already attachment wounds with someone, then they will enact things in their own intimate relationships. So it feels difficult to have to ignore some of that when you're just working at a level and your behavior.
Yeah. I'm the same, even when I work for agencies, you know, when there's a specific reason that the agency is funding a session. And for me, I can't focus just on that, because you can see that whatever the thing is comes from a history. And for me, in how I work, I find it very hard to work on the one thing of what's presenting. It's like, I want to go further.
And I think people who would facilitate groups like that, who perhaps had more of a grounding in support structures, groups, whatever, and weren't necessarily psychotherapists, they had a better way of just managing the curriculum and doing what you had to do. And then I'm kind of like, oh, my God, there's all this other stuff going on. and it's just trying to juggle that, I think. I mean, I loved it, and I also found it deeply challenging.
Yeah, thank you for answering. Yeah, so going into that group, yeah. What after the bit we've talked already, what's coming to you around that, that you would want to share with our audience?
Yeah. I guess what I would really like to say is, how influenced I've been by Irvin Yalom, or Yalom is how the Americans say his surname, how influential he's been on me as a therapist and group therapist. So he is a psychiatrist, American psychiatrist. He's written countless books, but his approach to therapy, I mean, it's not so different or controversial these days, but back when he was probably first practicing, it was very different, because he was very interested in the here and now. So, you know, what is going on in the space between therapist and client. So very gestalt, you know, what's in the space between. But he really took that into the group space. And rather than encouraging people to talk about the thing that happened last week, he would want to know, how are you feeling right now? When that person said that, what happened for you? And what might that say about you in your life? So when I was teaching group work at university level a few years ago, I encouraged my students to really get in touch with this idea. And in fact, in our practice therapy groups, that's the sort of thing we did. And if you can tolerate it, it's the most amazing way to learn, you know, to be experiencing something in real time and have it available, rather than thinking reflectively about something that might have happened, you know, a week ago. It's amazing.
Can you say more on tolerating it? What that means?
Because it's so uncomfortable. And particularly in a group situation, you've not only are you witnessing yourself maybe at your most vulnerable, but other people are witnessing you as well, which is why psychotherapy groups need such commitment from members, such very clear group agreements and structures that help people really understand, what are we doing here? because safety is an important thing in groups. So vulnerability and groups, that's what I mean about needing to tolerate that, because you can just feel very exposed. And it's feeling exposed isn't usually something people look forward to.
Can you give an example of what sort of conversations someone would be having that would be embodying that witnessing of whatever was happening in you in that moment?
So what might happen in a psychotherapy group is that there might be a conversation just happening between participants, and so I might start to shut down or just say some things that show that they're defensive. And then a facilitator might actually draw attention to that and say, what you said just then suggests that you're having a reaction to what so-and-so said. Can you say more about what's going on for you? So a facilitator is actually then putting the spotlight on something that's happening. And then it's about, can that person get in touch with what's going on and then be able to say it? And maybe even as a facilitator, you might direct participant to say something to the other person. Can you tell that person what was going on for you and how you felt when they said X or Y? And then, of course, you might ask the other person to respond and say, well, what's going on for you? Think about, are these sorts of things that are happening now, do they happen in your life in other times? So you're trying to get people to draw connections between the energy in the room and then how things happen in life. Because what Yelam always says is that if something's happening either in the therapy room or in the group space, chances are it's happening out in the real world. And you can learn from it because it's available.
I love that. As a facilitator in that context, what is a facilitator of groups as well? Sometimes where I feel torn in the direction of a training or something is when someone's more in story mode than what's real, like what's here right now. And like you're saying, there is that capacity, like how much of the now can you hold, and the now can involve the joy. Like sometimes it's the joy that's not able to be held. Sometimes it is that vulnerability of sadness or grief or anger, whatever those pieces are. But then one way I notice people will go into protection is just start telling stories about how it relates to something else, like past or future, rather than being in, oh, that actually made me feel vulnerable. So like, how does that play in?
Yeah. Do you mean, what do you do with it? Or
is there a concept or a way that you would navigate that?
Yeah.
Thing, or do you just let it go?
I reckon it depends on what stage the group is at. Are they just forming? Are they more comfortable? Where is the group in its development? And if it's early, you might let it go, because too much too soon is probably not helpful. But if it's sort of later on in how the group is developing, then you might just draw attention to it. But always in a way that's like you're offering choice or curiosity. Not, you know, you're doing it wrong or this is not okay. That's not helpful at all. I think being in a place of just curiosity is the most helpful, the most productive.
Makes sense. That pings me to ask you about the stages of the development groups or therapy groups, like whatever.
Let me see if I can try and remember. You know, like there's the forming, storming, norming, performing. I remembered, but I don't know if I got the order right. So forming makes sense that it comes first when people are sussing one another out. You know, who might they relate to? You find that people often come in and want to sit in the same spots, you know, to just have a sense of this is what this group is and this is where I sit. And, you know, I think I can relate to you, but maybe not so much you. So there's a fair bit that goes on in the forming, and it's basically the task of a forming group is, can we do this? You know, is this going to work? I think storming comes next, where...
Yeah, I just looked it up and you're correct. Storming, norming, performing. I was like, I'll make sure so that you do it in the right flow.
So I'm impressed that you looked that up and I didn't even notice.
I love it.
Okay, so dorming is a classic in terms of a little bit of can we push the boundaries and is this going to be a safe container? Again, a bit more of can we do it if we play up a bit. Then the norming is we've worked it out. We know what we're doing. We understand what this is. And then into the performing of, you know, we're actually getting somewhere, feeling like we're learning or changing or developing. Of course, that is a beautiful place to be. Not every group gets there, but groups that do, you know, you don't want it to end. It's so powerful, so enriching.
There's also an adjourning. This is a later fifth stage known as mourning. Marking the end of the project and disbanding the team.
Absolutely.
I think that's an important phase as well. It's a very real phase.
Particularly groups that stay together for a long period of time. Often what they do, this is a classic thing, they say, can we have a reunion? You know, can we come back in, you know, like a couple of months? And now and again I have done that and it's worked, but usually it doesn't because people do actually have closure. So they think they want to keep revisiting, but they do manage to put it aside and say, well, it's finished now. But sometimes having the possibility of getting together can help them actually let go. Yeah.
I like that. I really notice it because our trainings are shorter, so they're normally 2 weekends, but you're holding that intention over the 2 weeks. And there is that sense of where people really want to reconnect, but it also life, like you've had this really intense experience for a short period of time and then life happens and people go their different ways. And the way that time weaves with that makes it really challenging to reconnect, even if the intention's there.
Exactly right.
So back to the question, how do you see the role of the facilitator in each of those roles, forming, storming, norming, performing, and joining a group therapy?
Probably a facilitator is most active in the first two stages of the forming and then the storming. You can imagine people coming in feeling pretty anxious at a start of a group, and the question they have forefront of their mind is this safe? So, you know, in a forming situation, you do group agreements, which they all, like a bit of my bugbear is ones where people are told what the group rules are. You know, I've been aware of groups that go like that, and maybe sometimes that is appropriate, but my preference for groups is that they create agreements rather than rules and they do it for themselves. When there's buy-in to the agreements, they're much more likely to respect them and adhere to them because, like, hey, we created this, so we're going to stick to it. But yeah, so safety is so important, but you know, you can't just guarantee safety. You can't.
One of my bugbears is that I'm in a space and someone tells me it's a safe space. It's like, you don't get to decide if this is safe for me. At least that how I see the spaces I facilitate, I'm like, I can't guarantee it's going to be safe for you. Because I don't know what your triggers are that will mean unsafety, even if I do my very best to create the most nourishing and aligned container, I can't promise safety and no one can tell me I'm safe when I don't feel safe yet.
Absolutely.
Like that.
I hate it too, Gabrielle. My hackles rise and someone says, this is a safe space. It's like, why?
Yeah.
I feel you. It's tricky. So, like for me, the best you can do is create safe processes. You still can't guarantee the outcome will be safety, but safe processes in terms of setting up group agreements, addressing behaviours that might not fit into what people have decided, following up with people who might have been distressed, feeling like something's happened and that it can't just be ignored. So there are some really key things that facilitators need to do so that participants have confidence in facilitators holding the space. And that it, then if something happens and they have confidence in the facilitator, you're more likely to get through it. So to me, that's absolute sort of gold standard in terms of group therapy. That's in the forming. And then, of course, the storming is where I think as a facilitator you have to be your most alert and on guard, because if people start like throwing some things in and stirring things up, what are you going to do about it, you know? And you have to be able to tolerate it yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, I always say, I'm noticing I'm saying facilitators to you in this conversation. I also believe that groups should always have two facilitators. You need like two pairs of eyes on what's going on at all times, I think.
It's helpful. We had four for our most recent training, because it's like there's different tasks that differ from demonstration and technique. And then there's also those group dynamics. And then being able to, if someone is having a release of some sort or needing to process, someone can be checking. And I can't always have that. It's not always possible. But yeah, I prefer not doing it alone.
I know like there might be times where, particularly in an organizational setting, something happens and there has to be only one. But, you know, if that was the case, I think supervision then becomes even more important. It should happen anyway, that facilitators have access to regular supervision while they're facilitating. But yeah, just so the more you support the facilitators, the more likely that the group will be able to function as well as possible.
I actually find I know this is training, not therapy group, but it sort of is therapy group, because it's part of the way that we learn our practices. You're being worked on and you're receiving. So you are receiving a lot of therapy in essence, or body work, which is somatic therapy. So a lot is coming up on both ends of that, the learning and the processing. At this current phase where I'm at, that's the piece where I'm moving more into being more focused on the facilitators so that they can be nourished to support the trainees, because I feel like I understand the trainee process and that the space still requires a lot of support. But this training, I tried to really step back so that the facilitators could step in and I could work out what supports would benefit in a more removed way than I would have previously been in the space.
So you were like, it sounds like a very observational sort of role.
More, yeah. I'm thinking more of a structural and sustainability way of how we don't get I get life and changes and all that, but like burnout or unfair exchanges, those sorts of things, which can be unnecessary outcomes of too much pressure on the group field.
Right. That's interesting. I guess the other stages like around like norming and performing in terms of the facilitators, I think often that you may kind of step back a little bit, because depending on what sort of group it is, but the more the participants feel like they've got ownership, the more they can step in and actually be doing the work. Then I guess some of your decisions are what sort of interventions you might use, how much you might self-disclose. So, if it's a support group and you might actually be a peer facilitator, like meaning that you've experienced the whatever the issue is that the group is forming about, then you might disclose a bit around your lived experience, and that can be really helpful for that group. But then with the psychotherapy group, it's, I suppose, a little bit less clear just how much you might disclose yourself. But one thing I would often talk to my students about is even talking about how you're feeling in the moment is self-disclosure. And I think it's a really great way of being part of a group as a facilitator, is to talk about how things in the group affect you. Necessarily have to talk about your own life or things that have happened, but that the impact of the participants and that they have an impact on you and what that is, I think is important.
I love that. I had that realization 2 weekends ago where I think I had been using vulnerability strategically, but it had felt correct previously, as in I would drive to the Wānanga or to the training going, what
alive for me vulnerably now, and then share that as a way to be like, okay, not to make it a safe space, but sort of to make it like, okay, I'm sharing, so I'm open. I did that in the first weekend and it didn't feel right. Like the things I was processing weren't relevant to the group. I felt that as I was sharing and then the disconnect. And I came to the same conclusion as what you just said of actually what would have been vulnerable would be like, I'm really tender today. I'm sitting with that and sharing more from that space rather than from the space of here's why I'm tender, which is what I did. I went in, and then I went into story when I realized I was like off energetically.
I guess that's the other thing about being in a group therapy space is that you're also aware of your own kind of processes. So I love for you talking about your own recognition of what played out for you. That happens as well for facilitators in group therapy, is that you bring yourself. There it is.
How would you describe the performing piece? I don't love that word. I see it as, it's got a different performing to me is like when you're putting on a mask, and I practice, I guess, using it as an example. It's been when you're like, oh, I'm really Māori and I'm doing this body work, rather than being like, okay, who am I as I step into this field of body work? But that's not what it means in this model. So just clarifying.
I feel like what performing means for a group is that they are very much in touch with the work that's going on. So they aren't actually putting on masks and bringing their best behavior. They're being real and they're doing the work and being vulnerable. And I think about some of the groups I ran in the community organization where you see over the weeks bonds being formed, people feeling not so alone in their experience because someone said something and it's like, oh my God, I can so relate to that. And so the sharing of life experiences becomes more real, more vulnerable. And then people feel like, oh, I can really learn something from you. When you said that, you shared that, that's given me an idea. So all of that's kind of going on where people are being generous to one another. That's performing to me. Yeah.
In the adjoining phase, would that be where you see that follow-up piece from the facilitator or things like that? How would you see that phase?
Yeah, so that phase, and I guess it's a bit similar to an individual therapy where you made a decision that the therapy will come to an end in a few weeks or a month or whatever. It's so important to keep people in a group focused. This will end and you need opportunities to say the thing or express the thing or prepare for not coming next week. People have said all sorts of things about what am I going to do this time next week? Trying to picture the thing not happening anymore, the group no longer being in existence, and you have to prepare for that just to suddenly cut it off, I think is very jarring for people. So that adjourning phase or mourning phase, adjourning, is preparation for loss. And a typical thing that I have noticed in many groups is that you might have one or two people that don't show up on the last night because they can't do the end. They don't want to do it. So they don't come.
Interesting. I was just, that could be me, but it wouldn't be for me. I'm very different in that when I know something's coming to an end, it's just done. I don't need it. I don't need to honor the end.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And maybe that is also why some people might decide not to come. But it is something I've noticed where sometimes I've even picked, you know, who I think won't show up.
Interesting.
Yeah, because it feels painful, feels hard, and they just would rather not. We've done rituals in the last, a favourite ritual of mine, I do this with student groups as well, is that they all get bits of paper with someone's name on it of the group, and they might write just one thing, and we do say we'd like it to be positive about that person. So you might then get an envelope with, say, 10 bits of paper in it, And they're all things about you that other people have observed that they value. So to take that away is such a special thing. I know my students loved it. Times I had classes of 25, so to take a nice big envelope away with you with all these positive things, it's so good. As sad as I often feel, I usually love the last session because of the rituals around finishing that can feel so meaningful.
We don't do this anymore because now the trainings are just on weekends, but when they used to be over the week, we would on the last day put a korowai, which is actually in the back there, you can see it, the cloak, for each person, and people would say it to them.
Yeah.
It arises a lot of things because it's like that receiving of how you're seeing, the hearing of it, but also that speaking and generosity of what you've seen in each person. I got that activity from a rites of passage training with young teenagers, with young people. They did it as part of that training. And I was like, oh, that was such a cool thing to witness the young people doing it. And sometimes when their relationships were within the school system, they didn't have a good relationship, but then within that practice, they could find a way to see the good in the person. It was in bush, so they built a throne. And then each person had to sit on the throne. They'd built it with all the bush. They decorated it with flowers and leaves and stones. Quite a beautiful practice, right?
Oh, I love that so much.
Yeah. Offering that out into the wild. And then the other thing that was coming to mind as you were talking is, I don't always remember to do this, but I went to a dance workshop and the facilitator at the end, she was just like, endings are really weird, and just spoke it into the space. And it's like almost like you can feel everyone go, and people will say afterwards to me, I'm so glad you said that because I was really worried about the ending. Or it's just naming what we're all feeling. Like, this is weird. I've connected to you and I've got to go. Like, both of those things are true. I'm connected in this group space and I have to go and I don't want to and I do and I'm ready. That's all of
that. I love all of that. That's brilliant.
I think it's good for us to share our techniques that we use because it helps us to navigate some of these things, or when we're a bit stuck on it energetic, or like, oh, that thing always keeps happening, or it didn't feel complete for me. It's like, how do we honor that whole transition in a way?
That is a role of facilitator as well, is to kind of role model that, kind of just being able to say, well, this is what's here and it's normal. And if you struggle to do that, then I think it'll be hard for the group to be able to do it. So, gosh, the more I think about it, the more I realize how tricky group facilitation is as a skill.
It's so challenging. And even the kaiara here, the co-facilitator stepping into the role, as I just point out little things that I'm looking for, they're like, oh my God, I had no idea. Like, they're really skilled at the one-on-one work and they're already contributing generously to the space. So that's why I ask them often. They're already doing work behind the scenes. So I'm like, okay, do you want a more formalized role? But that shift from seeing things one-on-one to seeing the group field and seeing what the group needs and what will serve the group, rather than one person who might be noisy about their needs, but like going, okay, how can we use that noise for the group? It's actually a real big, big shift in thinking.
Absolutely. Really does make me think about the group space almost as an entity of its own. You've got all the individuals, but then you've got the energy and the dynamic and the feel and the vibe of what's going on that is so important to be tuning into and wondering about, being curious about, and trying to work out, well, you know, does this need anything? You know, has it got a life of its own that can be sustained? Do you need to enact something?
Yeah, I've been finding the shift to me that's occurring, and you do this so well from the groups I've been in with you. But as like previously, the trainings were like, I was the central pillar and all the questions came through me. And then now it's more like, okay, how can we all hold that space? All the participants, the trainees, the people making the food, we're all creating that space in the middle. It's not me. And just like moving myself out of that.
I love the way you've put that option.
Because that's the not sustainable piece for me, is that when everything comes through me about food and then about after and da da da, it's like, oh, my body actually and my system and my field can't hold it. But when I do that step back thing and go,
okay, how can we all be responsible for this space and the outcomes? And what if you have an individual thing you need, how do you bring that? So it's in the space for all of us. And quite often someone else will have the answer or the possibility.
Isn't that great that you don't actually have to have all the answers? Gee, you're reminding me of all these groovy things. I love this conversation. How cool it is as a facilitator to see the individuals in the group working something out or helping one another or having conversations, and you're just in it. And I think the important part about that is that they actually, I'm going to say learn, but it's not just about learning. I think it's about embracing something or really embodying something. That
almost take ownership for solving their own problems without it needing to go through a hierarchical thing. It's like, okay, that person maybe knows, realizing the wisdom in this space instead of like looking up for it. It's like looking out for it.
Yeah, that's beautifully described. I love that, what you said then.
Then that a piece is that follow-up piece. It's like, how involved are you after the group when there are maybe individual needs or attachment pieces? Struggling isn't the right word. I do enjoy it, and I'm in the process of creating some systems around it. I've probably had more of a mother energetic up till now, and I'm really wanting to step away from that to more of a like, okay, the space as a whole is a vehicle rather than I'm the vehicle moving this through.
Over the years, I haven't found too many times that I've needed a whole lot of follow-up for people afterwards. Now and again, people might think, oh, you know, can I come back and do some individual therapy with you? I'll often say, you know, that could be a possibility. We'll keep it in mind. But has that ever happened? Potentially it has. But I think sometimes it can be just a way of holding on to something about the group. When someone says, can I keep seeing you or can we keep doing this? I think for me, it's about resourcing people when they leave a group, that if there's more they need, they know how to find it. And it's not necessarily that they have to come to me for that. There might be other ways in which they can get what they need. And to me, that's more important, particularly as a sustainability sort of model. You can't be everything for all people in an ongoing way, but being able to resource people for them to then get what they need is important.
Do you mind if we switch a little bit to the supervision group aspect? How do you see the difference between a therapy group and a supervision group?
It's interesting because I was having a conversation yesterday. I do some peer supervision with someone and we were talking about supervision, and the line between supervision and therapy can sometimes get a bit blurred. I'm prepared to be in that blurred space because I think what's important is to be able to honour the person as therapist and be able to give space to what's there for them that might come up through work with clients and help them through recognising that to then work with their clients as effectively as they can. You know, what my peer and I were talking about is when the balance perhaps tips more into like therapy type thing where the clients get a bit lost in it, then the balance is probably off. So it's a constant having to watch the space and be alert to that to try and work out, okay, how are we doing this? How can we honour people in their life while they work with their clients? So yeah, it's tricky.
I've always really valued that with you, that if I had had a if something was happening personally, that I could bring that to the supervision space. Because for me, I am separate from my work, but also how I feel does very directly impact my work. That's because right. I'm unable to really show up if I'm off. So for me, it's the same thing. Also, I'm the sort of person who's very, it's different if I'm seeing a client, but if it's a more thing about me, I find it, like it would be pointless to me to talk about a client if I was really in something. It wouldn't land. Like I wouldn't even go in anything about it because my brain's not interested in that at all. So yeah, I really appreciated that capacity of you to be like, okay, yeah, this is what's important today. And then go back to the client piece when required as well.
I'm glad because I think it'll be something that I always worry about. You know, how's the balance going? Am I getting it right, getting it wrong? And of course, you're going to make mistakes, et cetera, et cetera. But it's good to know that something can work and be valued.
Yeah.
So in the supervision aspect, yeah, how do you see it when you are having a supervision group where people at different phases of their personal development or their, you know, counselling journey? How do you see that?
It's interesting. Actually, when I read the question that you sent, it reminded me of a group that I joined myself, a supervision group, and it ended up not working for me for two reasons. All the others, I think there are about maybe six of us, all the others were psychologists and I'm a counsellor, psychotherapist, and they were just starting, you know, in the first year or two of their practice, and I'd probably been working for, you know, 10 plus years at that stage. So a lot of what they wanted to talk about was the psychologist stuff of, you know, Medicare and systems and, you know, all of that, which just wasn't relevant to me. So we would talk about case studies, but I think our disciplines meant that I just didn't feel like I was a natural fit for that group. And I at times probably got a little bit frustrated with some of the things they were talking about, which were more beginning practice issues, which of course you have to be able to talk about. So in terms of supervision groups, it can be useful to have a group of new people together and they're all sharing their, gosh, this is really tricky. That kind of we're all in it, we're all in the same boat type thing is good. Otherwise, I think it can be good to have a range of experiences from people just starting out to people being quite experienced. And that diversity, I think, probably makes for the most enriching and lively group, because I know I still learn from people who are just starting out and want that kind of fresh thinking. So I don't just want to be with people who have been doing it for a while, you know. I really love the range.
Yeah, it makes me think about all her groups. So it's a group where it focuses on business and money in the therapy space or heart-centered space. It's usually therapists and body workers that come. But it's a range across the spectrum, and I find it so alive because everyone has their challenges with the idea of business and money. It's such a an alive space to look at our own things, but also to offer our suggestions and what we know and work through that. I found that it's been across that whole range. Some people have been in business for years and years, and some are just starting out, and some had their first clients while they were on the group. And so it was a really interesting in that way. So I agree with you in that, those two aspects of how it can sit. And it depends on where you're at in your life and what your purpose of supervision is as well, I think, from the individual point.
One thing that has been a ongoing awareness for me from being involved in supervision groups as a participant and also as a facilitator, that people often can feel de-skilled, you know, they might present a case and people are saying, you know, why don't you try this and this and this, and everyone's trying to jump on the bandwagon of what you can do to help this client. And so the feeling can be feeling de-skilled or not good enough. And then I think when people start to feel that, the supervision group starts to feel a bit of a challenging space, and people then start to not want to share quite so much because they're afraid of revealing something. For me, again, you can't guarantee that people are going to feel safe and okay, but it is something in supervision groups that I've always wanted to try and address in some way. I guess the way I've probably tried to get into that sort of space is ask anyone who might be presenting a case to a supervision group, might ask them, what is it that you need help with this?
Which comes into the help space. So it's a help energetic. Can I share what our rule is?
Yes, please.
So this has only just been forming this year, so I haven't got the languaging completely down in terms of what it is, but it's that someone describes the case, and then, because as you know, we don't always know what the piece is that's sitting with us, it's saying, this is a piece I'm stuck with. Do you have possibilities around X? It just changes the energy. Instead of I'm looking for advice, it's like, do you have possibilities around finding more clients? So that can be anything from finding a venue, finding more clients, looking for a space, to actually the client situation? Do you have more possibilities around how to handle my abandonment with this, or whatever the thing is? It can be broad or small. And I've found that then it does naturally lead to a really nourishing conversation for all participants, at least for my groups. It's like, I like this. What are the possibilities, or where can my mind be possibly think different around this? The help energetic is where, like, I'm the knower and you're the not. And what I've encountered in the spaces where that dynamic you described earlier, both in myself as the advice giver and witnessing others and witnessing a person receiving that, is it activates this, oh, they need help, rather than, oh, they're looking for possibilities. And with possibilities, it's also got this aspect of, you don't have to take the possibility that someone else is suggesting.
No, I really like that. That is so.
What are your thoughts around different personalities? So we talked, that was a discussion around like different phases of career or business or understanding with practice, with different personalities, introvert, extrovert, all different things. Is that something you see, or is it more intrinsic?
I think it is something that I see. I guess it depends on the type of group that you're working with around. Is there something that you need to be aware of or enact? I've found at times where I might think there could be a problem in the dynamics or different personalities. And if I inquire a bit more or try and get a sense of it, then the feedback is, oh, no, it's fine. So I might be looking for a problem where there isn't one. It's always that balance of how much do you intervene or take a step in addressing something, or just let the natural course of a group go. Because, of course, people do have different personalities and different needs and different ways of expressing. And the good thing about, particularly for supervision groups and therapists, it's just grist for the mill. It's like, this is our life.
Liveness is what we're alive for.
That's it.
I don't always know if they're being truthful. Not truthful, but I'm not asking the right questions to get the answer of what I'm sensing. Because I do trust what I sense. So I'm like, something's off. I just don't know what it is. And then when I ask how they are and there's no, I'm like, ugh. But then it's also letting it go. If they're not going to tell you, that's my part done. It's all good.
Exactly.
Something I've been really encountering lately, which is, it's just a curiosity and an interesting thing to me, is how some people have this perception or story that for a group to be functional, everyone has to be in the same energy or in the same vibe or in the same moment of transition. And I don't find that at all. Do you have thoughts on that?
I just don't think it's possible. I really just don't think it's possible. I mean, the work of a group is to be able to accept and be with the different feelings and presentations of everyone that's there, and for that to be okay, there'd be a real radical acceptance of that.
How do you know, say in a supervision group where it is ongoing, how do you know, or how do you decide when it's time for it to end?
I wouldn't necessarily make that decision. I would think it would be a group decision about, you know, an ongoing group that are working together. In the past, thought that the energy was such that the group needed to finish, but it was really just a couple of people, the time that had moved on for them, but the others weren't finished. So I think I probably could have asked better questions around that. But, you know, it can be a hard thing if you put some questions out to a group and then someone might be sitting with something and think, oh, I don't want to say that. And if, what if other people think different things? And so actually getting the real story from everyone is such a challenging thing. But I think ultimately people will work it out, you know, might decide, well, we will continue, but if the energy isn't there, you'll see that. And I guess it's just, you keep bringing that back to the group. I think, again, Yalom says, you just keep bringing whatever it is back to the group, bring it in, noticing this.
Ask a question about our group. How did that feel for you when we were having those conversations? Because I found it really helpful to witness the realness of that attach and detach and come back and then figure it out. When you were saying earlier, even how we began this podcast, is like, How do you hold that uncomfortability of real talk, of alive talks? How do you feel when you get drawn more into the field in that way rather than a little bit more as a facilitator or guide of it?
When I think about that period of time that you're talking about with the group we're in together, to be honest, I did feel vulnerable and exposed. I think I was picking up mixed signals, but I wasn't seeing it particularly clearly. And so I had a bit of a sense of, oh my goodness, I'm an experienced facilitator and I'm showing how I'm not managing something particularly well. So that felt really hard for me. But then because I had such a value of being real and honest and showing up, then that became the thing that needed to take over for me. So it was just like, okay, this is how it is. This is me being real. And I think I was able to move through that time in that way of just being genuine and then letting things flow as they will and let that be.
Yeah, such a beautiful experience for me to witness you allow that and also realize how challenging it was for you and all of us. And I just appreciate that I had that, was able to witness that, and that I stayed to witness that as well.
That's great. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
As we wind up, is there anything on your heart still to share at all?
I know I'm sitting with some gratitude of your place in that group for the years that you were there. I'm very much sitting with gratitude, and that we've continued to have a relationship post that group has been important to me. I'm really sitting with a feeling of privilege about the work of been doing over the years and how lucky I am to do it.
Thank you. And I just have one more question pop up in my brain. So I'm going to say it was around your book. Do you want to just talk a tiny bit on it so that people can connect with it if they feel pulled to you and your thinking and your work?
So the book was written with a client who was an ex-client by the time we wrote the book together. We wrote an article to start with about our therapy work together for a journal. That was an interesting thing to do, to have an entree into a therapist and client talking about their work together. It's happening more often, but back when we wrote the book, although it wasn't that many years ago, but it was kind of not as common. And the book, which is called Collaborative Writing and Psychotherapy, Flattening the Hierarchy Between Therapist and Client. Yeah, and we talked about hierarchies before. So to me, it was important that we could show the person of the therapist and the person of the client. And really, the therapy space is that those things come together and work their magic. So not to have that hierarchy of the person who knows trying to impart something on the person with a deficit, that to me is almost unbearable thinking. But it's about two human beings that care about one another and life and trying to create something together. That's the basis of the book.
I'll put the link as well in the show notes. And in our supervision space, we used to have, well, I'm sure you guys probably still do, but we had that tradition of reading a poem. So I have a poem. And I think I actually shared this in the supervision group in the past, but this is how I want to finish. So the poem is called There's No Such Thing as a Safe Space. So it's by Beth Strano. So there's no such thing as a safe space. We exist in the real world. We all carry scars and have caused wounds. This space seeks to turn down the volume of the world outside and amplify voices that have to fight to be heard elsewhere. This space will not be perfect. It will not always be what we wish it to be, but it will be our space together and we will work on it side by side.
Oh, I love that so much. That's beautiful. What a beautiful way to end, because I think it really captures so much about what group therapy does.
Thank you, Trish. Appreciate it. Thank you so much for your generosity and time.
Appreciate you back. Your energy. Loved the conversation.